This is an interview with Dr. Joseph Schwartz for the Youngstown State University History of Youngstown University by Randall Dix at Youngstown, Ohio on February 1st, 1974 at 2 p.m. First, Dr. Schwartz, I have a list of some of the significant dates in the university's history, and I wonder if you can think of anything else that should be included here.
Well, since I believe your concern with me is primarily connected with the School of Education, we probably ought to put in here the date in which the first teacher preparation courses were offered.
Mm-hmm. When was that?
Well, to the best of my knowledge and belief, it, these began formally in 1932. I would suggest, however, that you check one of the back copies of the catalog to make sure, because this was before my time, and I'm depending upon a memory which is getting a little bit hazy in some respects. But I think that in the year 1932, Youngstown College, it is unknown, first employed Dr. George M. Wilcox to set up a department of teacher education. I do not know whether there had been any informal teacher education courses taught prior to that time, but until he came, there had not been, I believe, any attempt to gain accreditation for the teacher education program. He came, and I'm pretty sure the year was 1932. As I say, you probably should verify this to be shown in the 33 catalog. Dr. Wilcox had his doctorate degree from Columbia University some few years before that time, and he instituted the Department of Education, beginning, I believe, with a program for preparing high school teachers. And then sometime later, again, I think you'd have to consult one of the early catalogs, they began offering courses for preparation of elementary teachers, probably sometime during the latter 30s. Again, I don't know the exact date, but this was accompanied by the employment of a specialist in elementary education, Miss Frieda Chapman. I'm not quite sure what her first year of teaching was, but she remained on the faculty until 1957. Retiring at that time. I myself came connected with the university for the 1949-50 academic year, beginning in September 1949. When I came here, now I don't know whether you want to continue in this vein, mm-hmm. or whether you want to interpose questions.
You've already anticipated my question.
Well, anytime you want to interrupt, then you're ahead. Let's see, as I said, when I came here in September of 1949, there were only two full-time faculty personnel involved in the Department of Education. The Department of Education had been organized as a department of the College of Arts and Sciences. And it so remained during the first 10 years or so of my joining the university faculty. I was the third full-time faculty member employed in the school of education, the department, then Department of Education.
How many students were there at that time who were majoring?
I don't know that I can give you an exact figure. My my answer will have to be at best a guess. But there was a surprisingly large number, considering there were only three full-time faculty members, because we depended very heavily upon part-time teaching of the education courses, with a great many of them being taught in late afternoon and evening classes. I think that even when I came here, there must have been 15 or 20 part-time teachers involved in education courses. There again, I don't know the exact figure. You could, of course, get those figures by looking at the catalog and seeing the listing of the faculty for the previous year. But that remained that way until, well, I think about 1957, we began to expand full-time faculty personnel in the School of Education. In that year, I think it was 1957-58 term, Dr. Wilcox retired as head of the department, and I was appointed as head of the education department, as unknown. I remained in that capacity until, and again, I think the year was 1960. The Department of Education was changed into a separate school of university organization. This, of course, followed the reorganization of the college into a university, and the School of Education became the Department of Education became a school of education, with my being appointed as dean of the School of Education. I was thus the first dean, although Dr. Wilcox was actually the progenitor and primary originator of the area, which later became the School of Education.
How had the department changed between the time you first came to Youngstown and between 1957 when you became professor of education?
We had expanded quite materially. Of course, the big expansion came during the few years just prior to my connection with the university, when what was a relatively small liberal arts college became almost swamped with students, largely as a result of the GI Bill following World War II. We were still in the middle of that expansion when I came here, or perhaps near the end of that particular cycle. See, I came in 1949. And while the veterans' benefits from World War II were beginning to phase out to some extent, the slack was then picked up by many other students, the expansion generally of college attendance on the part of high school graduates. I recall some figures which may be only approximate, but I think are fairly accurate. When I first came joined the faculty, the total enrollment of the Youngstown College was somewhere in the 4,500, perhaps a little over 4,500. During the succeeding two or three years, the enrollment gradually dropped off as the GI Bill factor reduced, until it reached a figure somewhere in the neighborhood of between 3,000 and 3,500. I would say this was within two or three years after I had joined. But even while this was happening to the enrollment of the university as a whole, the Department of Education was expanded and enlarging quite significantly at that particular time. I think your question was what happened between the years 1949 and 1957. We had expanded quite materially the number of part-time faculty involved in teaching education courses, but that I believe that we still only had the 3 full-time faculty members right up until either the year that Dr. Wilcox retired as head of the department or the year preceding that, somewhere along that we began to expand and take on additional full-time faculty members. And I think that from that time on, each succeeding year has seen an expansion in full-time faculty members. Part of that came as a result of the taking of accreditation, national accreditation for our School of Education in the early 60s, after it became a School of Education. One of the criteria for such accreditation called upon us to reduce the comparative number of part-time faculty. When I say comparative, I don't mean gross number, but the percentage of people involved, and to increase the number of full-time faculty. In accordance with that criterion, we began expanding at that time. I would have to go back and consult the catalog to give you exact figures how that expansion occurred. However, between 1957 and 1970, I think, was when I retired as dean, we had expanded from a full-time back 3 individuals to over 30 in full-time status. I don't remember again the exact figure, somewhere between 30 and 35. In the meantime, while we had reduced very materially the heavy percentage of part-time faculty, we still continued to employ quite a few. Although I think the total number was down, I would say that by the time I retired as dean in 1970, we had 30-some full-time and in the neighborhood of 15 or 16 part-time faculty members.
When the department became a School of Education, 1960, were there specific reasons for the change, or was it just continued development and increased enrollment?
A little difficult to answer that question because it depends in part upon speculation. I would have to say, and I don't want to appear to be undue credit to myself, I would have to say that it was, at least in part, due to my own activities and feelings that the prestige of our area demanded recognition as an autonomous school. At that time, we were enrolling a very heavy percentage of the total university enrollment. We were, in a sense, competing with colleges and universities all over the state, most of which were organized as schools of education rather than departments. We were, in fact, certifying more teachers in the state of Ohio than any other private institution. In fact, we were certifying more than some of the state-supported institutions. All of these things seem to bring about the desirability of an improvement in our status and relative autonomy. I can also say that there has always, in the history of every institution, been some conflict between the organization of the pure arts and science area and a professional area such as education. I, of course, have seen it work with reference to education, but the same thing is true for any professional group. The arts and science generally are not vocationally oriented to the same extent that of engineering or a business ad or an education group. Now, the School of Engineering and the School of Business Administration had already been recognized as separate schools prior to this. I felt very strongly, along with the support of my faculty, that this was a recognition due us. Consequently, I petitioned because the faculty joined in the petition Board of Trustees through President Jones to approve this change, and they very graciously went along with it.
What was the general reaction in both the university and the community to the change?
I have a way of noting that. We tend to be a little self-centered in all of our university operations.
How was the School of Education generally regarded by the Youngstown community?
I think that it is a very fair statement to say that prestige of our operation increased materially as a result of this situation. I do know that as the years went along, that we achieved increased acceptance in terms of the status of our teachers and our graduates over the status that had been accorded them in previous years. Now, I can say this quite specifically, and I think I can even quote figures to this extent. Actually, I don't think that I am out of line if I say that our graduates became well recognized over the entire state and accepted enthusiastically in all of the areas of preparation in which we involved. And I think part of this was due to the development of an autonomous school education.
What was your reaction to being appointed the first dean of the school?
I can't say that that was a great change or significant change. I slid into the job of dean from being head of department. It was more or less automatic. I personally felt no different about the situation. I think I should have parenthetically that as a department head operating under the jurisdiction of Dean Smith, I had acted very, very much autonomously before that, and we were, in fact, pretty much of an autonomous organization in everything except name during my entire tenure as head of the department. So the transition was very, very smooth and almost unnoticeable.
Were there any particular advantages which the school had, which becoming a separate school, which it hadn't had as a department?
Yes, it gave us increased participation in administrative organization. It gave us a little more jurisdiction in front of our own faculty. As I've already indicated, it added somewhat to the prestige of the organization. I think there might have even been some other advantages. It increased our recognition among the other universities and colleges within the state. And it enhanced our communication with the State Department of Education in many ways.
What did you see as the problems which faced the school at that time in the early 60s?
Problems, are you speaking of the School of Education or the university as a whole?
Well, the School of Education in particular and its role in the community.
Of course. We were in the same situation as most of the teacher preparation areas at that time. There was a continuing shortage of teachers throughout the area, as well as throughout the state, and in fact, throughout the nation. this was a result of the population increase, expansion after World War II, the great increase in the population, particularly secondary schools. We were pretty much occupied with turning out enough teachers to meet the demand during most of the 60s. This continued very much right up, in fact, until the time I retired as dean. And so one of our major problems during that time was to secure competent faculty personnel who had the credentials to satisfy our accreditation standards. This was a continual struggle during that whole time. We've been very, very fortunate, I might add, in that respect, in comparison with many other schools and universities.
What were your goals, ambitions for the school at that time? What did you hope it would become?
Well, we were all looking forward to the institution of a graduate school sometime in the near future, and of all of the schools in the university, the School of Education, that was most ready to move into graduate work at the time the school was established. This is not meant to take any credit upon our shoulders. It was just due to the fact that this was where the major demand for graduate work resided in this particular community. In fact, I think it is true even now. I don't know current figures. I haven't kept up during this year, but last year I understand that at least 75% of the enrollment in graduate school was in the School of Education or for education degrees. I suspect that it's still somewhat in the neighborhood. The demand has increased there. So this was one of the things we were looking forward and getting ready to do. I've already mentioned the problem of accreditation. We had been fully accredited almost from the very institution of the teacher preparation course as far as our state was concerned in terms of certification and recognition. But there was a great push on this business of national accreditation, not only in our school, but all over the whole United States, occurring during the late 50s and early 60s. And we were part of that movement. My own reaction to this national accreditation is somewhat mixed. I'm not sure that it is always and in every respect a completely good thing. I think some of the criteria, some of the standards they employ are a little unrealistic. Sometimes I think they may actually deter creativity and individual experimentation. They tend to put everybody in kind of a mold. Nonetheless, in the environmental conditions with which we were operating, it became almost a necessity to continue to expand. It becomes almost necessary to say, well, we have met the highest standards of the group. So accreditation was a constant problem during the early 60s. We were handicapped by facilities. As you know, the university did not begin to expand in a material way in terms of buildings and equipment of this sort until after we became affiliated with the state. We were still operating as a private institution. There was a lack of funds for a lot of the equipment. Certainly the building facility that was desirable. We moved a great step forward when the these purchased the public elementary school on Elm Street and gave it to the School of Education as their building. Of course, with the understanding that the whole university shared the facilities, but it was our primary or primarily our tremendously. And I think it was the disease factor in our achieving national accreditation. We had had a dissertation by the accrediting committee prior to that acquisition. And while they did not turn down our movement for accreditation, they didn't approve it either. We were in a sort of state of limbo. They issued a number of requirements that would have to be fulfilled before that they would consider accreditation. One of them was expansion of space and facilities for faculty and school operation. Well, I could go into some detail on that. There were a great many things involved in that. Eventually, President Jones and I met with the we were actually operating with two separate accreditations at that time. One was the NCATE, as we call it, the National Council on Teacher Accreditation, and with North Central as it for accreditation and approval for a separate school education. I remember that the North Central had held us in abeyance in the same way. And President Jones and I made a trip to Kansas City, Missouri, at one of the meetings of the North Central group to present our altered or modified statement, which did include the purchase of the building for the school of education. This did result in our receiving complete accreditation, and we've continued and improved our status ever since that particular time.
In what year was that?
That would have to be the summer of 64 or 65. Do you remember, do you have anywhere the figure year in which Dr. Pugsley succeeded?
No.
I think it was in 65, and if so, that was the summer.
All right, I'll check that. It was said in 1965 that the School of Education produced graduates who reached into every section of the area and influenced students from all sorts of family backgrounds. Is this accurate, and do you think it
Say that again, I'm not quite sure I followed you.
The School of Education produced graduates who reached into every section of the Youngstown area, who influenced students from all sorts of backgrounds.
Yes, I don't think the School of Education was unique in that respect. I think that was a characteristic of the total university situation, as one of the things that had always endeared the Youngstown University and previously Youngstown College to me was the total unity mix, which was characteristic of the school, of the whole institution. Certainly it was per School of Education. I think not less, not more so, nor less so than for the whole university. This is one of the real characteristics, unique characteristics of the institution, which I noted when I first came here and strongly opposed.
It was also said that without the Youngstown University School of Education, area schools, and by area, it was meant as far away as Cleveland, would have a hard time finding teachers. Is this accurate? And
oh, yes. Of course, I guess the same thing can be said for institutions which produced a significant number of teachers during that period because, as I say, we were operating in an environment of teacher shortage, which we inherited from World War II, and we continued right up until approximately 1970. And of course, it just suddenly, within a year, turned over into the opposite direction.
What was the reputation of the school in the, after 1965, in the late 60s, just before the university became a state university? Had it changed since 1960, when you became dean, when the school was first?
Well, almost, if I answered that to the direction you are leading me, I would appear to be self-serving, which I do not wish to be in any sense of the word. We improved our prestige greatly, primarily because we increased our facilities, expanded our faculty, not because of any deficiency in the early group. I'd like to make that clear. I don't know of any individual who is more capable of managing and directing a teacher preparation facility than Dr. Wilcox, my present predecessor, in any sense of the word. And if I say that we improved our image, that is a natural concomitant of the expansion of the area, the shortage of teachers, and I think the continued dedication of the people involved. Now, I don't know whether I am talking around the subject. I have no feeling that I personally did anything in this direction. I hope I didn't hinder in any way. But I think it was just a natural growth and a natural development which did continue throughout this particular.
What was the attitude of the students? The School of Education had a large proportion of the total student body. Was education considered an easy major, or was it a popular one?
You're sort of getting into the area of some of the classic controversy that centers around a multiversity that I wouldn't, I'd like not to get involved in the continuation of any controversial ideas on this particular thing. Let me approach this indirectly. One of the features which attracted me as a candidate for faculty membership when I first came here were published standards for teacher preparation curricula in this college at that particular time. At a time when teacher education curricula in general, teacher education candidates in particular, were frequently, in many colleges and universities, taken from the lower academic strata of the college population. Youngstown College maintained a very strict and high academic standard for its of people for candidacy for teacher certification. I'm sure you're aware of this fact. In fact, our insistence on academic and scholastic qualities often precipitated some controversies in the university community itself. But beyond shadow of doubt, our insistence and our holding to these very high standards, at the time I speak of, we had the highest standard for admission, the highest scholastic and aptitude standard for admission to teacher preparation of any university or college in the state. I say the highest. I think there was one other private school that had about the same, but one small private school which I won't name because I'm not sure of the exact figure. But beyond that, most colleges and universities required nothing more from their Teacher Education candidates than they meet the bare minimum standards for graduation from the university. Whereas we did maintain and actually operate and held to these very, very high scholastic and aptitude standards. I think there's no question in the world but what this improved our status. In other words, our people were competent people. They were from the very top of the group. Now, getting back to your direct question, there have always been some elements of controversy between areas of professional and general or classic education. By that I mean primarily many arts and science faculty personnel have tended to sneer a little bit at some of the aspects of professional preparation. And by the way, that was not directed exclusively at education. When I use the word professional preparation, I again refer to the whole spectrum of vocational preparation as opposed to classical education. And this began in college and university circles very early with the establishment of the very first separate department for schools of education. There has always been some tendency to, for certain individuals of a faculty, not only our university, I think we have less of it here than most places I know of, to look down their nose a little bit at the intensely vocationalized aspects of higher education. To that extent, we have had many claims, sometimes public, more often expressed as comments from dissident arts and science faculty people about the SNAP courses required for an education major. Actually, those were not applicable to our situation for the simple reason that in our operation we did not accept students into the School of Education until they had proved their academic capacities by two preliminary years in the College of Arts and Sciences. By that, whether they were actually enrolled in the art and science as they were until 1965, I guess, 1965 or 1967, I'm not sure, or whether they were listed as freshmen in the School of Education, nonetheless, their first 2 years of work has been a general curriculum taught almost entirely by faculty of the College of Arts and Sciences. There were the standards which applied to their admission to the School of Education were those of university-wide standards, not the standards of courses or marks that they got specifically in education courses. Now, I'm not going to enter the controversy or whether or not the content of education courses is comparable to the content of classic studies. I don't think it's necessary or important to make that distinction. Certainly, there is a difference. There are many, many different kinds of college studies. I usually say there are at least two distinct types, not only in education, but anywhere you go. I can compare education courses favorably with such areas as philosophy, psychology, all of them belong in the traditional liberal arts curriculum, sociology, and most of the social social science area. They are quite similar in that they do not specifically emphasize the content aspect. I think now my own particular discipline, my original teaching discipline, my major area was in the field of mathematics and physical science. Now there's a difference between the type of material and content courses in those areas and those in the areas that call for philosophical consideration. I am taking advantage of this opportunity to philosophize a little bit. I don't know whether I'm answering your question directly or not. Well, I think that's enough on that. Let me just simply say that in the long run, those students who have been recognized as outstanding students in school of education have almost without exception been the same students who achieved high superiority in their College of Arts and Science courses. And that, I think, ends the whole controversy.
When was the graduate program in education first offered?
Well, perhaps better consult the catalog. But my feet are a little bit tough right now. We were among the first. I mean, the School of Education was included in the first group that offered graduate courses, along with the English Department of Arts and Science. And I'm not sure. Perhaps better check through the graduate catalog on that to the executive. That would have to be, I think, the fall of 67.
So then it was when
we were.
It was as Youngstown State University. And it was after the university had become a state university.
Well, it would be this first year, if I'm correct.
As you said, you saw the growth of Youngstown University from a small private college to a large state institution. What would your general reaction to the change, the growth, and development be?
Well, you're getting into the area of personal considerations, which have very little objectivity. I can give you my own personal reaction. I don't like multiversity. I never did. One of the reasons I came here first to begin with, the fact that it was a small private institution. In that sense, I did not particularly welcome change. That is not critical, not meant to be critical of the thing that happened within the community. I think the university was blackmailed into the situation, to be perfectly frank. They had little or no choice on the matter if they wished to survive. Therefore, I'm not criticizing the individuals who made the change. But for me, there's always been a lot more opportunity for creativity and genuine dedication to the cause of higher education within a small, compact, well-integrated community group, which becomes impossible. I don't like a lot of the things that have happened, but I suspect they're inevitable. And again, I'm not saying this in any sense of blaming the individual. individual was involved. I sat on the group, the faculty advisory group to the president, which endorsed the change. I was a member of that particular group, and I went along with them because, as I say, I think we had no choice. I think the administration in Bush at that particular time made it very, very clear that if we didn't go along with what they proposed to do with us, they would shut the competing state institutions. In fact, they even went so far as to appoint a group to develop that kind of thing. So that's the answer.
In 1955, Youngstown College was rechartered as Youngstown University. Now, what was your reaction to that change?
That was simply a recognition of a factual condition. We were already operating as a university. It was everything, that was merely a change of name to accomplish what was being done. So we already had separate schools, we had a university organization. Now, a typical college organization doesn't have individual vocational and professional schools operating under. Well, as I say, I don't think that in itself was anything more than a recognition of what was being done. The same thing happened at roughly the same time with such institutions as Pennsylvania State University, as it now is, somewhere in that same area of time. They moved over Pennsylvania State College to Pennsylvania State University, merely a recognition of the fact that they were operating as a university and so on and so forth.
There wasn't any real change?
Not significantly, no. It did not change the administrative organization. Now, I could add here, one of the things that I don't care too much for under state operation is the tendency to proliferate non-teaching personnel. The tendency to get into administrative details so much more, it sort of tends to isolate faculty from students and faculty from staff and so on and so forth. What happened here was that, in one sense of the word, we lost much of our unique character and simply became a carbon copy of most of the other state universities' operations.
When you retired as dean in 1970,
now, remember, I retired only as dean. Yes. I continued teaching at that time.
Well, in 1970 or 1974, how do you look back on both your time as dean of the School of Education or as a faculty member? And
well, at heart, I've always been primarily a teacher. I you're getting not sure that they're pertinent to this history situation, but I'll be happy to answer your question. I never sought an administrative job in any of my teaching times. Where they have been tendered to me, I expected them, done what I possibly could on the thing. One of the very serious problems in all educational organizations is the tendency to polarize the relationship between administration and faculty. I think that's happened here to a greater extent since we became a state university. But there's always that element present. This is the cause of so much of the unrest in our public schools. This is the cause of the sharp separation between boards of education and teachers as organized groups and so on and so forth. I don't know what the, you should talk to somebody else for an evaluation of my own administrative capacity and efficiency. I'm not certainly a person to pass upon that. I will say that I've never enjoyed administering to anywhere near the extent that I enjoy simple, ordinary teaching, whether it be classroom teaching or innovative types of teaching and so forth. I try to operate in the best possible manner that I could. By the way, I'm not referring solely to my situation as dean here, because I have been in administrative capacity in other of my teaching assignments, and when I was a Navy officer in the long run, I wound up as an administrator, not fully a speaking line officer. I wish that we had more empathy between administrative groups and faculty than we seem to have anywhere in our educational organization. I think our educational organization has made a mistake in copying the line of staff concept of industry, which is a dog-eat-dog operation. Always has, probably will be, due to the intense competition involved there. But somewhere along the line, we missed our boat on education in adopting the military or industrial type of line organization rather than cooperative or even, hard word, communistic approach to relationship and education. Communistic, I certainly don't mean Soviet type of communism. I'm talking about the crude sharing of responsibility and relationships. Now you got me off on another tangent. I'm not sure what your original question was.
Well, I was asking what your feelings were about your earlier ambitions for the School of Education, your reaction to your tenure.
Well, as I say, it's a matter of purpose. I never particularly enjoyed being cast in administrative roles. But I recognized it had to be done. And there are some things that an administrator has to do that he can't help with. For instance, I criticize many, probably most, school superintendents that I know for the polarization that they develop between them, I'll use that word again, and their faculties. And yet, I recognize that the fault lies not primarily in the superintendent themselves, but in the system, which makes it impossible for them to operate as a superintendent unless they do adopt that attitude. In other words, the gap, the division is between the lay control member and the professional aspect of education itself. The typical superintendent wouldn't last a year as a superintendent if he did not accede to the wishes of the Board of Education to employ him and in effect dictate his policy. Now, once in a great while, you see an enlightened community where that doesn't exist. But it's fairly rare. And the same thing holds true at a certain point in the administrative relationships at the college and university level. Less so, I think. But still to some extent.
In an hour, I'll probably think of the things I should have asked you. Is there anything you can think of that I should have asked?
Oh, I don't know if anything you should have asked. I still feel that teaching, and I'm not going to distinguish between the different levels of teaching, because when I write down what my profession is, I have always used the simple word teaching. I've not differentiated between whether I was teaching a first grade or a graduate class, and I haven't put in college teacher or college dean. I simply use the word teacher because to me that is the basic aspect of the whole situation. I know there's a lot of criticism about teaching as a profession. It's very good to me. I don't think I would have changed very much of anything that has gone on in my own career insofar as it relates to my teaching and operating function. It's a good deal like some of the other professions that I think call for a certain amount of service concept. It's been a very satisfactory operation. I have particularly enjoyed my association with Youngstown College and University, primarily because it seems to me of all of the institutions of higher education with which I have been associated in various capacities as a student or teacher, we really accomplished something here in terms of the nature of our student population and the real satisfaction of the demand. I don't hold too much with this idea that there are some prestigious institutions of higher education which hold the key to excellence in academic preparation and so forth. I once elicited a great deal of incredulous comment from one of my classes, but stating flatly that the quality of education did not necessarily differ in any of the institutions. We have a habit of looking at such institutions as Harvard University as being extremely prestigious and offering the best in education, and I shocked the group by saying that an individual at Youngstown State University can receive just as good an education as at Harvard University or at any other place. It depends upon the individual himself and wants to get out of it. The facilities are there, the passions are there, and I don't go very much for this business of prestige and classification of education. I think it goes back to the individual. In that sense, Youngstown State University or Youngstown College and University has done a magnificent job in terms of meeting the requirements of its own particular community.
Thank you very much, Dr. Schwartz.